I have been obsessed with trying to figure out what are these near-death experiences and how do they fit with what the scriptures say and have revealed.
Many folks are skeptical of the whole thing and would simply attribute it to something that's happening in the brain while people are dying. Does it somehow undermine scriptural revelation or wander into pseudoscience or something like that?
My dad's dying. Someone gives it to him. I see it on his bedside table, pick it up, like, what is this? I couldn't put it down. I read the whole thing that night. I said, oh my gosh, this Jesus God stuff may be real.
Not every near-death experience is an experience of light and beauty. There are some folks that have a much more sobering or even negative experience.
These people, like Pete, described what I was doing in his resuscitation in such a way that I could have used the recording to teach other physicians how to do resuscitation.
What if you never die? Because your basic life is that constant flow of experience, thoughts and perceptions and feelings and desires and choices. And he says, if you trust me, that's going to go right on.
You're not going to miss out on anything. Nothing.
Jesus said a long time ago in John 14, do not let your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. You trust in God. Trust also in me. And then he goes on to say remarkable words that we are going to focus on in particular with my friend John Burke. And I'll introduce you to John in just a second. But Jesus says, my Father's house has many rooms. If that were not so, would I have told you that I am going there to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the way to the place where I am going. And those words contain the hopes and cycle around the fears that lie maybe deepest to us as we try to live with an untroubled heart. And John has done immense study and research around this topic, and I was thrilled when he said that he would have a conversation with us. John and I worked together many years ago in Chicago at Willow Creek Church, and then he went on to be a pastor for many, many years in Texas, and has written a book that hundreds of thousands of people have read, New York Times bestseller, Imagine Heaven. So I'll get to that in a minute. But first of all, John, I'm just so grateful. Thank you for being willing to have this conversation.
Oh, absolutely. Great to see you, John.
Yeah. Well, I am, as you know, in Santa Barbara, you have been here and you used to live here a long time ago. And when Jesus talks about preparing a place for us, I think it will look a lot like where I am.
I agree. I used to say that, like, okay, this is about as close as you get on earth. And we love Santa Barbara. It is my favorite place on earth. It's my happy place.
It is a happy place. We're talking today about a subject that's always fascinating to people, but it probably gets a lot more informal, anecdotal conversation than it does serious thought or academic thought. And it's about this promise that Jesus has, that he is preparing a place for us, a life for us that will go on beyond this life. Yeah. And one of my best friends, just as you and I have in this conversation, had his sister pass away yesterday. Nancy and I, in our life right now, just have numerous folks where that experience of walking through the valley of the shadow of death is going on. And so it's a topic that can never be too far away from the human mind or the human heart. And John, you've done remarkable work where you have looked deeply at what did Jesus say about this topic and what do the scriptures say about this topic? And then there's also a whole field of research called near-death experience. And over the last 50 years or so, a guy named Raymond Moody wrote about this like 50 years ago, and that sparked a line of research. So you have done a ton of work on that and trying to integrate those kind of studies with what it is that Jesus and the scripture say. Say a little bit about how did you get into this topic and what have been some of the highlights of the journey?
Yeah, so you know, I never shared it when we were working together, but I have been obsessed with trying to figure out what are these near-death experiences and how do they fit with what the scriptures say and have revealed. And it goes all the way back to my coming to faith. So, you know, I was an agnostic, because I kept asking people, you know, growing up and in church, like, how do you know Jesus is the Son of God? Like, legends happened. How do you know? And nobody could answer. And I saw no evidence for God. And so I was just kind of like, I don't think there is a God probably, but who knows? There's just no evidence. And then my dad was dying of cancer. And someone gave him Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life, which is the first book of, you know, chronicling about 70 of his students who, when he did a class, he was a professor, did a class on postmortem survival, you know, studying the Plato and the philosophers. And every class, two or three students would come up and tell them about this experience they had. And he started to see the consistencies in it. And anyway, he writes that book.
And for people who don't know him, Moody had a PhD in philosophy from Virginia and psychology and an MD. So yeah, he was not a flaky fringe character kind of guy. He was a responsible scholar.
Yeah. And, you know, so he puts this in a book. My dad's dying. Someone gives it to him. This is like 3 years after the book came out. I see it on his bedside table, pick it up and start like, what is this? I start reading it. And I seriously, I couldn't put it down. I read the whole thing that night. And here's what I said, John. I said, oh my gosh, this Jesus God stuff may be real.
Wow.
And so it didn't lead me to faith, but it opened my heart and my mind. And a year later, a friend invited me into a small group Bible study. I said, I got a lot of questions. You're probably going to kick me out. And I said, come, you know, and I asked all my questions. I started to understand the gospel, but also the scriptures. And I came to faith in Christ. And then I was working as an engineer out in Santa Barbara. So I, you know, I moved from Austin to Santa Barbara, and I lived there 7 years. And so what's interesting is I had this obsessive, like, okay, I now believe in Jesus. I understand the scriptures. What are these near-death experiences? And more of them were coming out. Now, here's the interesting thing, John, is only looking back did I realize Santa Barbara in the 80s, when I was living there, was the place that most of the near-death experience research was taking place. So coincidentally, I kept coming across them, hearing more and more, and I literally started to chart, like, oh, okay, I keep hearing this. Oh, well, that's in the Bible here. Yes. And in 1989, I gave my first evangelistic talk on this topic of near-death experiences in the Bible at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
Oh, my gosh.
You're probably like, you know, I didn't know he was interested in this. Well, yeah, imagine if I had said, you know, in our church then, oh yeah, I'm into near-death experiences.
Well, that's part of what you write about in the book is that many folks are skeptical of the whole thing and would simply attribute it to something that's happening in the brain while people are dying.
Yes.
And that also often Christians may be skeptical about it because they wonder, does it somehow undermine scriptural revelation or wander into pseudoscience or something like that? So as we talk about this, we'll talk about both the near-death experience side, but also what it is that Jesus in particular in John 14 and other places talk about the reality of afterlife. Say a little bit about how do you respond to folks who are pretty skeptical on the topic of near-death experience?
Well, I think it's good to be skeptical. I'm still skeptical. I don't believe everything every near-death experiencer says. And I think the reason that's important is to realize they are interpreting an experience that truly is beyond our dimensionality. So imagine the best illustration is, imagine that we are living this three-dimensional life, but in a flat two-dimensional world. Okay. Yes. So we have up and down, we have side to side. We don't even have in or out. And so death means separation. So at death, your flat two-dimensional soul is peeled out of that world and brought into this three-dimensional world that was always there all around you. In fact, you can even look back in and see what's going on in your two-dimensional world. You're experiencing something, and this is what near-death experiencers say, more real than I ever experienced in that world. Why more real? Well, because you're still your two-dimensional self, but with expanded experience of who you are and what life really is. That was actually a diminished experience. And this is exactly what near-death experiencers are saying. Now, in Imagine Heaven, what I'm doing is I show that there are about 40 commonalities of what near-death experiencers all around the globe, and I've studied about 1,500 of them now and interviewed people on every continent, and they're consistently saying the same things about these, about 40 characteristics of the life to come, and they're all in the Bible. And so I'm showing you where they're all in the Bible and how this is just confirming that. Now, however, what they report consistently aligns with the Bible. How they interpret what they report might not.
Yeah.
So, for instance, someone might leave their body. They say, I still had a body, but it was a spiritual body, but I was still myself. In fact, not just myself with five senses, more like 50 senses, kind of like superpowers, right?
Yes.
Which is interesting because I think the Apostle Paul might have had a near-death experience in Lystra. You know, Acts chapter 14, he was stoned to death and dragged out of the city and left for dead.
Mm-hmm.
And then the believers pray for him and he gets back up and goes back into the city and starts preaching again, which, you know, it's like, try again, buddy. You know, like I wouldn't do that.
Yes.
But in 2 Corinthians 12, he says, 14 years ago, whether I was in my body or out of my body, I don't know. Only God knows. But I was taken up to the third heaven. I was shown paradise and heard and saw things inexpressible. So maybe he was referring to that time
experience
in Lystra 14 years earlier. But then Paul writes about stuff that fully aligns with what near-death experiencers are saying, like 1 Corinthians 15, our bodies are buried a natural body, they're raised a spiritual body. They're buried in, and the word is dunamai, the Greek word, from which we get our word dynamite. They're raised in power. You know, they're buried in weakness, but they're raised in power. And they talk about these new powers of sight, communication. Some of them call it telepathy, but it's more than that. It's thought to thought, heart to heart, all the associated understanding. It's pure. They're like, you can't misunderstand. Travel that is, you know, out of thought or slow, almost like gliding or flying even, which all that sounds so new age until you realize, well, wait a second, Jesus did that.
Yes.
The resurrected Jesus, you know, which we celebrated Easter, he just showed up in a room.
Yeah.
And yet he said, touch me, give me a piece of fish. He ate it. Right.
Yeah.
But then he could go right through the walls and then they watched him float up into the clouds. I mean, now this body's version 1.0.
Mm-hmm.
When we die, we get our spiritual body version 2.0, but Jesus got a resurrected body. He's the first fruits of version 3.0, where the earthly body is reconstituted to the spiritual body. So he can interact with both the earthly realm and the heavenly realm.
And that's what we look forward to, ultimately, you would say, when the resurrection comes for everybody.
Heaven,
so let me give you a quote,
and
I'd love to hear your response to this. You know, another person who was very interested in the description of what happens after we die here, but also in near-death experiences, was Dallas Willard, a philosopher. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think that. He taught on this, and I think there's a file of information that he collected over the years. I'll try to connect with you later on that. As you may know, there's the Dallas Library here in Santa Barbara at Westmont, and you might be interested in looking through that.
I didn't know that.
If it's available. Yep.
Even though he was at USC?
Yeah, but he gave his library to Westmont College in Santa Barbara.
Oh, so, okay.
It's now located here, and I will check in with you on that. Could be interesting stuff to look through.
Well, you know, I mean, J.P. Moreland, who's a philosopher at Biola,
was a student of Dallas's. Yes.
They all have looked into this and been like, yeah, this is evidence. This is evidence of everything that we as Christians believe.
And I think partly because it can involve such unusual, or often people, Christian or not, think of afterlife issues in heaven and hell in kind of cartoonish images. Mm-hmm. Or because bizarre stuff can be said, we don't think about it deeply.
Right.
And in a secular age, there's often just the assumption that the only serious thought is you die and that's it, without ever asking, now, how would we know that? So here's the quote from Dallas I'd love to get your response to. Not long before he died, I'll talk about this sometimes here at Become New, one of his comments was, I think after I die, it may be some time before I realize it's happened. And he does one talk where he says, what if you never die? Because your basic life is that constant flow of experience, thoughts and perceptions and feelings and desires and choices. And he says, if you trust me, that's going to go right on. So it may be that that transition will take a while. Here's what he writes in The Divine Conspiracy. Common human experience in all ages and cultures teaches more about transition and passage, the transition and passage involved in death, than Western culture for the last century or so has been willing to deal with. Some of it has been reaffirmed and perhaps over-embellished by the recent interest in near-death experiences. But what common human experience thus teaches is in basic accord with the indications to be derived from biblical sources. Most notably, the person in the transition, that is someone who's in the process of dying, begins to see the invisible. Others whom they know come to meet them, often while they are still interacting with those left behind. If death is sudden, those nearby will have no opportunity to realize that this is happening. But we can be sure that even in such cases, the person is not hurled into isolation. You would not do that if you could help it to anyone you loved. And neither will God. Here we see the comforting mercy of God toward those who love him or seek him. Poor Lazarus died, we are told by Jesus, and he was borne away by the angels to where God's people are gathered, Luke 16:22. From the great cloud of witnesses come those who have been watching for us. They greet and enfold us. And while those first moments or hours will surely present us with one astonishing view after another, we will be joyous and peaceful because of the company we are in.
Yep, absolutely.
Your thoughts.
Well, you know, it's funny, John, because, and I like to point out that these people that you read,
yes,
in Imagine Heaven, or my new one, Imagine the God of Heaven, which is really focused on the attributes of God and the story of God. But they are spine surgeons. They are CEOs, bank presidents, commercial airline pilots, people who have nothing to gain making up crazy stories of dying and going to heaven and seeing Jesus, and yet they say it's the most real thing that's ever happened to them.
Yeah, I think one of the books you write about is by Evan Alexander, who I think is like a Harvard neurosurgeon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, interestingly, so I debated him on a European podcast, because he's a good example of someone who, if you read what he reported when he first came back, which he wrote in Proof of Heaven, It all aligns with the scriptures and it aligns with what these other near-death experiencers have said, but his interpretation has now changed. Yeah, and so that can happen.
Right.
That can happen.
Yeah.
But yes, these people still are incredibly credible people. Now, What I was going to say is Dr. Mary Neal was a spine surgeon whose kayak got pinned under a waterfall in Peru for 30 minutes. So she was dead 30 minutes, revived. And she cried out, "God, your will be done." And she said, "I was immediately and tangibly held by Christ." And she said, and I said, "How did you know it was Jesus?" And she said, I didn't have to ask. Just like if I turn in the hall and see my husband, I don't have to ask, is that my husband? I know, yes. Who it is.
Yes.
So it was that even more of this intuitive understanding. And that's true of people all around the globe. And, you know, she starts to tell me this whole experience. And I said, so do you know you're dead? And she said, "Well, not yet, because I didn't feel like I died. I felt like I was conscious and then more conscious, alive and then more alive."
Mm-hmm.
And that is commonly what they say. And so what I like to say is, yes, I mean, Christians also, all people, I think, have a bad view of heaven and the life to come. But even Christians, you know, we hear, well, it's going to be an endless worship service, an endless church service, which I'm a pastor, you're a pastor. That sounds bad to me, right?
Yeah.
And what I like to tell people is, no, think about life and everything you enjoy and love about life. Because guess what? You only love it and enjoy it because the Creator made you with the ability to love it and enjoy it. And that life goes on, but it expands.
Yeah.
Into new dimensions of time, new dimensions of space, and new experiences. And so, you know, Jesus wasn't kidding when he said, "Store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where things can't touch it," because that's the real thing, right?
So when Jesus would say things like, God will say to someone who is faithful in little, "Now I will put you in charge of 10 cities." That's a picture of the kind of work and responsibility and challenge and adventure that yet lies before us, as opposed to sitting on a cloud, playing a harp and singing forever.
Right. And in the last chapters of Imagine Heaven, I write about that, how to give you a picture that this place, the holy city of God, is, I mean, as Dr. Neal said, so she sees through the gates into the city, and she said, "I saw people, I saw angels, and they were very busy." She said it was like this city bustling with life. Mm. Another person, Don Piper, who's a pastor, who was run over by an 18-wheeler, dead for 90 minutes, the jaws of life had to cut his body out, and then he revives. And he says he's looking in, and he said almost the same exact thing.
Good.
It was like full of life. And he said, you know, think about when you're in the zone, right?
Yeah.
So maybe you're creating, your work is not work. It's like, where did the time go? You're right. Experiencing this almost eternal moment of lost in enjoyment of the creativity and that. Well, that's what it's like. And yeah, we do all kinds have responsibilities.
All kinds of research around what's called the state of flow, where you're engaged deeply in something, you're very aware, but you're not self-conscious. And one of the marks of flow is your sense of time is altered.
Yeah.
And it sounds like there we're getting a little taste of what you're saying. Actually, the afterlife, life together with God, will experience that in an exponential way.
Well, you know, Peter said in 2 Peter 3:8, to the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years and 1,000 years is like a day.
Yeah.
Well, near-death experiencers have said almost the exact same thing to me. Yeah. I don't know if it was seconds or minutes or hours. Some of them said, there's no time on the other side. But the others have said, no, there is time, but it's like you have all the time. So at each moment, you have all the time you need. Or others have said there was past, present, and future all simultaneously. I'm telling you in a linear sequence because that's the only way we can describe it, but it didn't happen that way.
Now, another interesting connection with people being able to identify Jesus and I hadn't thought about this till reading an interpretation of this pretty recently, on the Mount of Transfiguration, when the three disciples are there, and there's Jesus, and there's Moses and Elijah, and the disciples immediately recognize them and say, there's Moses and Elijah. Now, how did they know? Because obviously there were no pictures of them, and they had never seen their faces. And
name Dallas tags?
Would write about how there is a presence of a person's presence that can become known to us, can be palpable to us, and it is a spiritual reality. We think about it with body, and of course, bodies are the way that it's mediated to us, but actually right. The presence of another person is simply knowable to us, and it is a spiritual presence.
And that's what they say, is I knew
yes.
him, like Captain Dale Black, was a commercial airline pilot.
Yeah.
Died in a plane crash in Burbank. I've seen the LA Times footage of the wreckage. In fact, I show it in my podcast. And I mean, the plane was obliterated. It hit 135 miles an hour into a 70-foot high monument and just was obliterated. Everybody died, but Dale came back.
Wow.
And he describes God like gave him a flyover into the holy city. Because he knew he was an airline pilot and he would love that.
Wow.
And he's describing it just like John described in Revelation 21. But yeah, the life to come is real, and this life, they commonly say, is like the shadow, and that's like the real thing. Which is interesting, because even in Hebrews 8, it says that God had Moses build the tabernacle according to the pattern he showed him in heaven. This, they worship in just a shadow, a copy of the real thing in heaven.
Fascinating.
So imagine if all that we're experiencing is really like living the shadow of something even more tangible and more real that's
so,
to come.
Instead of the afterlife, as often in the ancient world and still in our day, I think to people it feels like a fog bank and vague and cloudy and ethereal,
wispy.
If it's the other way around, and actually that's what we're experiencing right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think God is raising up these near-death experience testimonies as evidence, and it's just evidence, it's just testimony.
Yeah.
You know, just kind of like if in Jesus' day after the resurrection, you went and you interviewed 100 people in Jerusalem, 50 would say, yeah, I saw him. He did miracles. Yeah, he raised the dead. Yeah, he's a sorcerer.
Right.
And others would say, he did miracles. He raised the dead. How can you not believe he's the Messiah?
Yeah.
So they all say that they're seeing the same thing. They're reporting the same thing. They may have different interpretations, but these are just, they're eyewitnesses of the reality. And many times Jesus sends them back and he says, I want you to tell what you've seen and what you've heard. And I think he's raising up these testimonies. And in Imagine the God of Heaven, I interview people from every continent and every religious background. And they're not seeing the gods that would be in their brain if this is just brain-based.
Yeah.
They are seeing the God, and they come back. And sometimes he gives them like parables. He doesn't always just tell them who he is. And they have to come back seeking. But when they seek, they find.
Say a little bit. I'd love to talk about a couple of the images that are pretty common. Jesus here in John 14, part of what he talks about is the idea of a home. That he's preparing a home, that we are not yet fully home, that there is a home that we have to look forward to. And you write about that aspect where often people will have this sense of coming home. So tell us a little about that.
Yeah, so Karina Martinez was well, let me tell you Santosh's story, because I think his is just so fascinating. Santosh's a Hindu. He grew up in India. The Hindu scriptures were all he knew. Never read the Bible. He was a manufacturing engineer. Traveled the world. Very smart man, right? He goes into the hospital when his pancreas, his gallbladder erupts into his pancreas. They can't get his heartbeat down below 200. They can't operate. He codes. he hears code blue. And he said to me, you know, I thought when you die, you come back as another life form, but that's not what happened. He leaves his body, but he's still himself. He could see his body on the table. And he said, this divine light comes to me brighter than the sun, like by thousands of times, would have burned my retina out if I had been in my human body. But I fell in love with this light because I knew this light knew me and was for me. And this light takes him, and they travel, and it's through like this portal, which is another commonality, to a place where he is standing up, looking out over what he described it to me as, it was a giant compound, thousands of miles long, square shaped, gorgeous inside. Now, I've been to India many times, and there are walled, gated compounds everywhere. And so as he's describing the holy city of God, and he says there were these huge, gorgeous walls all the way around. It was square shaped, thousands of miles, but my eyesight was telescopic, so I could see, you know, all throughout, which initially I thought, okay, that's kind of new agey weird. That's not in the Bible. Well, actually it is. In Revelation 21, John is taken up to a very high mountain overlooking the same holy city, right? And Captain Dale Black describes that mountain as higher than the Himalayas, because he described the same city. And yet John is able to read the names on the foundation stone of the city. How? Unless he has this telescopic eyesight they keep talking about.
Yeah.
And so Santosh describes this. He wants to go in because here's what he said. He said, I knew that was home. I knew that's where every human belongs. That is the longing of every human heart. And he described it literally. He said, gorgeous grounds inside, just beautiful gardens and fountains and hills and mountains, because it's huge. It's thousands of miles. And mansions, he used that word. Mansions, gorgeous large buildings made of otherworldly building material. Which I thought was fascinating because he's a manufacturing engineer.
Yeah.
And it is fascinating when you hear, because I've triangulated even like Mary Neal talking about the same wall, or Don Piper talking about the same wall around the city. And it's like, she said, it's like the archway of like a Roman archway that you would go in. Captain Dale Black described it as it was physical. And, you know, it had kind of like a dark kind of color to it, but it was also made of light, one would say. But Mary said it was made of love. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, I know that sounds nonsensical, but that's what I understood. It was physical, yes, and you could touch it, but it also felt translucent because it was like this light and love was coming out of everything.
Yeah.
So and I had a blind kid. So this is not only that there are verifiable observations when people die. That was the first thing that convinced me when I was a skeptical engineer still, that when people are first out of their body, they watch their resuscitation.
Yeah.
And like this one cardiologist I interviewed, Dr. Michael Sabum, said, you know, he set out to disprove near-death experiences. He starts interviewing his patients. He said, these people like Pete described what I was doing in his resuscitation in such a way that I could have used the recording to teach other physicians how to do resuscitation.
Wow.
He could not possibly have known these things.
Yeah.
And yet he did. That's one of the things that convinced me. The second thing that really convinced me is people blind from birth, having a near-death experience, they can see, even though when they're resuscitated, they're still blind. So Brad, this blind kid who I interview, he describes coming to this heavenly realm, and it's this gorgeous field and flowers and palm trees. And he said trees far taller than anything I'd ever heard about on Earth. And the light was coming out of everything. And it was palpable. It wasn't like the light of the sun. It was love and life and light coming out of the grass and the trees and the birds and everything. Now, interestingly, that's exactly what near-death experiencers agree on around the world, that the light of heaven, there's no sun or moon, and it doesn't work like light on Earth.
Yes.
It's instead light that is also love and life that is giving life to everything.
Yes.
Now, most Christians don't even know. Isaiah the prophet said that in 680 BC. In Isaiah 60, he said, there is no sun or moon in heaven. God is its light. And then John in Revelation 21 is looking out over and describing the same holy city that Santosh is describing and says, there is no sun or moon, for the glory of God is its light, and the Lamb, Jesus, is its lamp, and the nations will walk in that light. And that's exactly what people are saying, that, you know, God is love. And by the way, remember, Jesus on the mountain was transfigured, and they said his face and clothes shone brighter than the sun.
Yes. Yep.
And Jesus says, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life.
So there's a remarkable consistency, even when the reports are coming from people that do not have a Christian background or would not know those scriptures or images.
Or couldn't see or couldn't and would see. Have never heard on Earth that light shines out of everything. Where'd they get that idea?
Right.
And yet I recount the testimonies of six blind people in my books, and they're all saying the same things that sighted people are about the commonalities of heaven.
So let me ask about the flip side of that. Part of what you write about is a being of light is often experienced by people, and the sense of God being a person of immense compassion and love. But another kind of common dynamic is people experiencing something like a review of life. And then that can also lead to issues of the sense of judgment and evaluation, and that not every near-death experience is an experience of light and beauty. There are some folks that have a much more sobering or even negative experience. So say a little bit about that and how do you understand it?
Yes. So in one study done by the International Association of Near-Death Experiences, where they interviewed, I think it was like 1,300 patients who had died, had near-death experience, 23% reported having hellish near-death experiences.
Wow.
More recently, the European Academy of Neurology did a study across 35 countries. They reported that 10% of the population claims to have had a near-death experience. And even a higher percentage were negative. Now, I dove into that research. I honestly think, and I try to limit what I report to those who have actually clinically died, or they were like, there was something that was, you know,
an objective,
they were on the edge
measure
of death or clinically dead, not just like I had an experience. So I think it's closer to 5% of the population, which
that
aligns
had a
with
near-death experience.
Who've had a near-death experience. And that aligns to the Gallup poll that found that 1 out of 25 Americans. Now, think about it, that's 13 million Americans. Mm-hmm. We're talking about millions of people all around the globe. And what people don't realize is this has been studied. I mean, you know, Dr. Sabum, who I talked about, he wrote an article for the Journal of the American Medical Association after 5 years of trying to scientifically disprove near-death experiences and came to the conclusion, no, there's something real here.
Yeah.
And it's been published in another cardiology. So in JAMA, in The Lancet, Europe's most prestigious journal, Dr. Pim van Lommel is another researcher and cardiologist I interviewed, and he reports on these. So my point is, you know, the three things that convinced me when I was still a skeptical engineer that these somehow must be real. And then it was kind of like, well, how does it all align? But one, verifiable observations. There have been studies done showing that near-death experiencers, 92% of their observations while out of their body are completely accurate. Another 6% are mostly accurate. Only 2% in this study, which turned out to be one patient, were inaccurate. So that grounds this in our reality. In other words, they're in another dimension watching what's going on in a flat in the two-dimensional world.
Yeah.
Second, blind people having the same experience exactly and describing eyesight and describing things they couldn't have known that they saw. And then it checked out when they came back. And the third thing that convinced me, John, is that people of all cultures and all religious backgrounds, when they have a near-death experience, if they are in the presence of God, he's the same God. And they're not describing necessarily the gods of their culture. They're describing the God who revealed himself to Moses as this brilliant light that didn't burn the bush up, right?
Mm-hmm.
On Mount Sinai.
Yeah. No, and it's interesting. It doesn't sound like there are many accounts of polytheistic beings, multiple gods.
No. Yeah, so Santosh, who I was describing, you know, he sees and describes this holy city. It's home. He wants to go in. And then he looks down to his left, and I believe this is a vision. I don't think hell's right outside the holy city. I think God let him see. And what he describes is that because he's like, I don't know how to get in, because he sees the 12 gates, but they're closed to him. And he's like, where am I? He looks down and there's an abyss. He called it an abyss of darkness with a lake of fire that he would fall into. And he's like, it scares me to this day, even thinking about it.
So is that said, when people do have accounts where it turns darker or more hellish, would your understanding of that be that is kind of a warning about the possibility of an afterlife experience that would be one of judgment or separation from God?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And I think it's God's warning of it's all real.
Yeah.
That's what he told Santosh. Mm. So after he sees this and he's like, I don't want to go there. I want to go in the city. I can't. Are there any other options? And he said, going back to someone else's body was never given to me as an option. Even though he thought reincarnation was, it wasn't given. He turns and then he sees who he said he knew that this was the Almighty on this giant throne, but in the form of a man. And he looks up and he looks into his eyes and he said his eyes were like lightning. And his face like the sun. And as soon as I looked into his eyes, my whole life, I saw all my life and all my sins. And I realized I deserve the abyss. And he drops to his knees and starts saying, Lord, please forgive me. Please forgive me. Please forgive me. And then the Lord speaks to him. And he says, Santosh, I'm sending you back to the earth. And when you go back, you must love your family and especially your daughter. She needs your help right now. And he was blown away because he said, wait a second. Okay, who is this God? And I expected him to cast me into hell. And yet in his voice, I heard such mercy and tenderness and compassion and love for me and even my daughter. How did he know my daughter and what she needed?
Wow.
And then he sees and he sees to the right of the throne. And now this is wild, John, but I think God sometimes gives people parables, even in a near-death experience. I think that's what this was. So he sees he called it a very narrow gate just to the side of the throne open to him through which he could go into the kingdom of heaven. It was the only gate open. And he called it was so narrow, it was kind of shockingly narrow to him. So he called it a narrow gate or narrow door. And he said to the Lord, when I come back, he got confidence because he felt such love and compassion from God. And he said, when I come back, how do I go through that narrow door? I want to go through that narrow gate into the kingdom of heaven. And he's thinking, you know, what mosque, what temple, what church, what do I religiously do?
Yeah.
And the Lord said to him, no, I want to see how honest you are with me, how real. I want relationship, not one day a week, 7 days, 24/7, 365 days a year. Walk with me. And Santosh said, I was confused because here's this giant. That's how he appeared. How do I keep step with a giant? He was like taking it very literally.
Yes.
And then he says to Santosh, the wages of sin is death. Don't keep on sinning. Surrender yourself to me daily. And Santosh said, I should underline completely in your daily life. And Santosh comes back. And he is seeking. He's like, who was this guy? This was not like the gods I know of in the Hindu scriptures. Who was this almighty giant who he described as just like the risen Jesus, right? You know, in Revelation 1, it says his eyes were like flames of fire. His feet were like glowing molten bronze. Santosh described his feet the same way. And he starts seeking, he's praying every day, God, who are you? I want to know you. I want to, you know. And 2 years later, his daughter, who was a choral major in college, is invited to sing with her friend in a church at Easter. Santosh goes to hear her, walks into the church, and feels the same loving presence he felt in this experience. And the message that day was Matthew 7. You must enter the kingdom of heaven through the narrow gate.
Wow.
And then John chapter 10, where Jesus says, I am the gate for the sheep. All who come in through me will be saved. And Santosh was just blown. He was like, it was like the message was just for me. He goes home. He starts reading the Bible. He said, everything I experience is in this book.
Well, I love that.
And he became an amazing follower of Jesus. And we were, yeah, it was,
I love that parable of the flatland. I think it was Edwin Abbott who wrote that. Mm-hmm. And just, I think it can help all of us make sense of both the imagery in scripture and then conversations from other people trying to make sense of or describe or communicate spiritual reality, which is just going to seem weird or going to seem strange or going to seem difficult to articulate. But it has to be done in terms of stuff that's familiar with. John, this has just been fascinating. I'm so grateful. I mean, this could go on for hours. I hope folks who are interested will read both Imagine Heaven, Imagine the God of Heaven. You are a pastor, so I'd love to wrap up by having you speak as a pastor to folks who are listening to us, and maybe they have lost somebody to death, or maybe they are facing or fearing that in their own life. I know of people who I love who are walking there. For all of us, whether we try to shove it out of our minds or not, we all face that reality. We are all going to die. And what lies beyond that is an immensely important question. And then, you know, Jesus comes with these words. What would you have to say as a pastor to everybody who is listening to us about this incredibly important topic of death?
Well, the first is that, you know, Easter is our reminder that God sent Jesus to overcome sin and death and all fear. And so in him, we have nothing to fear. And for those who aren't sure, maybe if they're right with God, you know, relationship with God is a free gift. He created us to love him and to experience his love. Fascinating. That's the consistency of a life review. People come back saying God is love and how we love one another is what he cares about most. And so love only requires a choice. Will I accept the love of the other and will I give myself in trust and love to the other? And that's why God doesn't force us. But if you want relationship with God, heaven is his free gift. And all you have to do is turn to him and say, I want what Jesus did to count for me. You know, I want your forgiveness. I want your leadership. And what I would say for those who are, you know, maybe afraid of death or have others there, you know, one thing I've seen again and again and again is you don't know what happens in those last moments. I can't tell you how many people have told me, John, you know when you're dying. And God is pursuing people to the very last minute. And so many of them do turn even in the last minute. And he is so merciful and kind and gracious, paid an enormous price for it. But all who call on the name of the Lord are made right with him. Hmm. And I've seen that. And then what we have to look forward to is so much more life than you've ever imagined having. You know, I also often, you know, say to people, you think that going all out following God, you're somehow going to miss out. You're not going to miss out on anything. Nothing. Everything is not only that you thought was lost is restored, but there's so much to come that's so much better. You know, Jesus wasn't kidding, you know, when he said to the rich young ruler, sell all and follow me and you will have so much more. And the guy didn't believe it, but it's true.
Right.
No. You know, it's true that there is nothing that we will be sorry for because we lost something in this life if we gave our all to wholeheartedly follow him. And that's what I would say is, you know, he's not trying to take anything away from us. The truth is he's trying to help us not just to grab hold of things that aren't going to last, because it's not helpful to us. But when we hold them as his gifts in an open hand, we enjoy them with him in a new way, but also they make a difference for an eternal life that's to come.
Well, for everybody listening to us, I hope you will think really seriously about what Jesus said about preparing a place, and that your real life lies before you, and that you will live today with an untroubled heart. John Burke, this has been fascinating. I'm very grateful. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much, John. It's great to see you again.
You too.
Hey, before you click off, go ahead and hit the subscribe button to our YouTube channel. That'll help us reach more folks. Become New is dedicated to growing spiritually one day at a time, and we do that through brief teachings each weekday. So if you subscribe, you won't miss any future episodes, and we'd love to hear from you. So you can chime in the comments here, or if you're not a part of our Facebook group, right now we're doing something interesting. I'm posting a video there each day to correspond with the video that's released here with a question that you can engage with, and I'd love to have you add your voice to that conversation. So you can find the link to that Facebook group in the description below. You can also find the link to follow us on Instagram or X, where we post regular inspirational posts throughout the week to encourage you in your spiritual growth journey. If you have a prayer request, there's a group of us who meet each weekday to pray for viewers just like yourself. So be sure to not carry that burden alone. We would love to come alongside you. You can text a request to the number 855-888-0444 or email it to us at connect@becomenew.com. Remember, the most important thing about your life is the person you become. We'll see you next time.